This vocation talk by Father Dominic Legge of the Thomistic Institute was given at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C. to a group of young men thinking about entering the Dominican Order.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me to be here and to have a chance to speak with you all. I myself was once sitting pretty much right where you're sitting, not the same physical chair. Back then, this was the library, actually. It was a great experience for me to be working in Washington, D.C., and then to discover the House of Studies and to get to know the friars here and to come and share a little bit of their life. I remember very distinctly one experience that I had while I was here. I had been thinking about the priesthood for a while and thinking about, you know, the possibility of the religious life. I'd met the Dominicans while I was in law school, and so I knew a little bit about them. I knew a few friars anyway, but I didn't really know what the life was like. And then when I came here on the vocation weekend, it really was a great grace to feel like one thing was just noticing the way the brothers interacted in the refectory and in the recreation, and they just enjoyed each other's presence. It was a religious life that was very serious, you know, in the chapel, the theology, the preaching of the gospel, taking seriously what it means to be a consecrated religious. And at the same time, it was human. You know, it was like real people living a real human life. And I visited some other places that didn't strike me that way. They struck me as, you know, perhaps very heroically austere and impressive because of that. But I couldn't quite see myself being able to live there in a human way. And what was very striking to me, and I think it's a deep truth, certainly a truth that St. Thomas Aquinas would agree with, that when the Holy Spirit's grace is at work, it takes what is natural and it makes it even better. It raises it, elevates it, imbues it with a new kind of life and a new spirit. And that's what I felt like I saw here when I was a vocation candidate, that I saw men who were more at peace, more who they really were, more at home, more joyful, more spirit-filled than I was in my job out in the world. And I wanted to be like that. And that's one of the great graces, I think, of living the Dominican life and of living in this house. It's one of the things that I relish the most. This is just it's a great community. I love living here. I love being here. I mean, I had a career before I came here. This is way better than anything else I ever did. And I have absolutely no regrets, not even for a moment. I love it. I wouldn't be doing anything else. You'd have to force me to leave. God forbid that anything ever would force me out, because this is just where I found my great happiness. There's a great story about one of the early Dominicans named, Reginald of Orleans, isn't it? He was a master of theology. That means in the Middle Ages, he was an important theology professor at the University of Bologna, if I'm not mistaken. I'm remembering this off the top of my head, so I might get it a little bit wrong, but he entered the Dominican Order, which, of course, you know, was at that point very, very small, not very reputable, and much more austere than the life he had as basically a diocesan priest and university professor, where he had a lot of money and he lived a more lavish lifestyle, and the Dominicans lived a very poor simplicity and so forth, much more time obliged to spend in choir, for example, in the chapel. And one of the brothers one day asked him, after he'd been living a Dominican life, it was towards the end of his life, said, "Well, Master Reginald, do you ever regret entering the order and giving up all the pleasures you had when you were still a master of theology in the university?" And he said, "I doubt very much whether there's been any merit in living a Dominican life for me, because I've always enjoyed it so much." And actually, I feel like I could say, at this point in my life anyway, very much the same thing. So I'm going to talk about the grace of preaching. That's my assignment. But maybe I can say just a word about the Thomistic Institute and what we do. So I'm on the faculty here. This is a faculty of theology. So in this priory, which is our religious community, we also have a school, which is the faculty. And in the school, that's our seminary, basically. So all the brothers, after their novitiate, come here and do their theology, philosophy and theology studies here. Normally, they're in the school for typically 6 years, sometimes five. It depends on the timing. And they usually live in this house for five of those 6 years, at least the way it's currently configured, assuming you're in for six before you're ordained, five before you're ordained a deacon. You live here until you're ordained a deacon. So there's the religious community, and then there's the school, which is in the same building, but they're two kind of entities. Okay, so for my job, as it were, I work for the faculty, which means I'm teaching our brothers and also some other students that we have here. But we have in the faculty something called the Thomistic Institute, which is kind of like a research institute. But what we do is take some of the work that we do in the school here out to the secular university and into the secular world. So just a few years ago, we started these campus chapters where students on secular university campuses organize themselves as a student group, which they call a chapter of the Thomistic Institute, so like the University of Virginia chapter of the Thomistic Institute. They get permission to organize events on campus once they're a student group, so they can put up posters, they can reserve rooms. And then we give them a menu, a list of speakers and topics. It's about now, I think, 130 speakers and topics, with really top-notch Catholic intellectuals, some of them Dominicans, many of them not Dominicans, other lay scholars. And we say, if you want to put on any events on your campus, pick from this list, and we will help you make it happen. So that's largely, I spend a significant amount of my time not only teaching and doing my own scholarship, but also going around and speaking on these college campuses and then helping organize these events and these conferences. So in 3 years, we've gone from zero to now a little more than 30 chapters, and we're having more than 200 events per year, and we think that it's going to keep growing. So it's really tremendously exciting, and I think we're building the Thomistic Institute to last for the long term. I mean, hundreds of years. So I hope, God willing. So if you join this outfit, maybe you can be a part of it someday. Not right away, of course. You need to go through your studies, but we need that. There's so much work to do. So much work to do. It is like, we say we're like, you know, a guy walking around in the desert with a big jug of water. I mean, people are just, they come to you looking. You don't have to do much. They just come because no one is talking about these things on secular campuses. So the truth of the Catholic intellectual tradition, we have such amazing resources to answer the very questions, the basic existential questions that people have today on campuses, that the kids on campuses are asking themselves, and no one is telling them that there is this tremendous body of very serious answers to their questions. And all you need to do is find out where to go read a book about it. I mean, there's lots of resources out there, and no one's talking about it. So we're just going onto campus, and even though we're very modest and limited in our own capacities, you can do a lot. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about that a little later in this talk. So this talk has two parts. The first is a brief history of religious life, just to kind of give you an outline of how to situate the Dominican order in comparison to other religious orders, and therefore understand a little more clearly what's distinctive about the Dominican order. Now, this might be review for some of you, but maybe not for others. And then the second part is about the preaching, which is at the heart of the Dominican life and the Dominican charism. So the grace of preaching, that's really what this talk is supposed to be about. All right, so a brief, very brief history of religious life. Starts, of course, with the master, Jesus. Jesus gathers around himself disciples who follow him and imitate his way of life. And, of course, they literally follow him. I mean, they're walking around behind him. and they're watching what he does and how he lives. And he lives a life of poverty, of chastity, and in the end, we see his total obedience to the Father as he goes to the cross out of love. So he empties himself of everything that is his for the sake of the life of the world. This is the icon of the religious life. This is the religious life. So the religious life is not a human invention. It is from Christ. And it is trying to live literally as a disciple of Christ, to follow him, to live as he lived. So if you enter religious life for other reasons, if there are other reasons maybe why you came here today, that's okay. You can come for many other reasons. But in the end, you probably won't stay unless you are coming to become a disciple of Christ, and a disciple of Christ in the most profound possible way. When you make vows, especially when you make solemn vows, that is, vows unto death, you are making vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and by those vows you are consecrated to Christ. You consecrate the whole of your life, not only this moment, but every future moment. And you become Christ's in a new way. That's the whole point. So there are lots of different concrete ways to live out that kind of consecration, of course. And you find then different forms of religious life. So after Christ, you have the apostles who try to literally live as Christ did after his death, resurrection, and ascension. They continue the apostolic preaching of Christ, and they live in community. We read about that in the Acts of the Apostles, Acts 2. They held all things in common, and they preached the word. This is, again, the kind of foundational beginning of the form of religious life. Later, of course, you will have martyrs. I mean, relatively soon, you will have martyrs. Martyrs are giving their lives like Christ gave his out of witness to the truth, witness to the gospel. And of course, that's what martyr means, literally means a witness in Greek. So the martyrs bear witness by their blood, by their willingness to be killed out of fidelity to Christ and to the gospel. And that's the most literal way of living out the religious life. You go all the way to the end. Now, after the age of martyrdom, of course, it's not possible simply to go all the way to the end. Although, if you really want to be a martyr today, you can find places where you can be martyred. I don't recommend it. The church has always said you should not seek out martyrdom. If it comes to you, that's one thing. If you go to it, it's another. Don't go to Syria and try to preach the gospel. They're going to cut your head off. And in fact, you might chicken out at the last minute, and then you'll be in a very bad situation. That's the traditional teaching. Okay, but after the age of martyrdom, there are Christians who continue to follow Christ as literally as they can, as fully as they can. We could call this in Latin, the little label for this is the sequela Christi, the following of Christ, literally the walking behind Christ. So how do they do this? They begin going out into the desert to live a life dedicated to prayer. They try to take literally Christ's command to pray always. And so they live in solitude. They work with their hands, manual labor, in order to support themselves. They give any extra income they have away to the poor. So they're living very simple lives. And the great example of this is St. Anthony of the Desert. And if you've never read anything about St. Anthony of the Desert, you can read his life by St. Athanasius. So St. Anthony was considered sort of the founder of Egyptian desert monasticism. There were others before him, but St. Anthony became kind of the most famous figure among them. He's, in a way, the beginning, you might say, the first great figure in the history of monasticism. After that, in the West, you have St. Benedict, And St. Benedict, of course, is the founder of the Benedictines. He lived this same kind of monastic life in Europe, actually in Italy. And he wrote a rule for monks, which is the rule of St. Benedict. Now, the monastery that he gathered, the monks that he gathered around him, his disciples, and the rule that he wrote became extremely influential. Actually, at the time that he began, there were other types of monastic communities, but Benedict's rule was seen to be so balanced, so wise, that it simply became the template for religious life. So basically, in the West, from the beginning of the Benedictine monasticism in the 6th century up through the Middle Ages, you basically have one principal model of religious life, and it's Benedictine monasticism. Now, there are some variations, there are some reform movements, there are a few other forms that pop up, but that's like the big feature. And what is the kind of characteristics of Benedictine monasticism? Well, it's very much like what you had with St. Anthony in the Desert. The motto of St. Benedict, maybe you know it, of the rule of St. Benedict, ora et labora. That's two Latin words, ora, labora. Ora means prayer, and labora, labor, manual labor, working basically with your hands. So it's a life dedicated to prayer, and to this kind of manual work, silence, of course, a very strong emphasis on the worship of God in the liturgy. So the liturgy in a Benedictine monastery is supposed to be beautiful and full. Lectio Divina. The point is for the sanctification of the individual monk and for his growth in perfection, and he prays for the world. But you see, the monk is staying in his monastery. These monasteries generally were in fairly remote places. Now, in some places, cities grew up around them. They're the places of Gregorian chant. People come. I mean, Gregorian chant really belongs, in a way, to the Benedictines. And monasteries are places where you can go to visit, to pray, but you don't really hang out with the monks. The monks are not going out into the world. The monks are withdrawing from the world to the monastery. Okay. In the 13th century, then, the beginning of the 13th century, you have the development of kind of urban renewal after the fall of the Roman Empire, and new cities are starting to grow. And into these cities, you have the two great religious founders of the 13th century, St. Francis of Assisi, who founds the Franciscans, and at almost the same time, St. Dominic, who founds the Dominicans. And both of these movements are characterized by keeping many of the monastic observances, but adapting them to a new circumstance. So with Francis, really the emphasis is on being with the people in poverty and simplicity, humility. St. Dominic, unlike St. Francis, was a priest. St. Francis was not a priest. He never was ordained a priest. St. Dominic was already a priest, and he saw the great need for preaching because of the heresies that were rampant already in the 13th century. So he wanted a monastic form of life. That's why we wear a habit that looks like this. That's why we pray in the chapel like you've heard us praying with the chant now in English, or the beautiful litany that we were just singing. These are elements of the monastic life, but adapted now not just for the individual prayer and contemplation of the monk, but also for the sake of going out and preaching to the world. So there was a need for evangelization and for a defense of the church's teaching, the church's doctrine. And so labora, in the motto of the Benedictines, ora et labora, labora is now replaced by the Dominicans with study. Why do you study? You study not only because it helps you contemplate the mysteries of God, very much that, but also because if you're going to be a preacher, you need to have something to say, and you need to know how to say it. And of course, there's also poverty as an evangelical witness, so it makes you more credible when you're living a simple life. And also, you're not working like the Benedictine monks were. they would work, and therefore they would have actually something to barter with or to support themselves with. Dominican friars are not working, and so not earning a living, as it were, so they have to beg. So they become mendicants, and that's what mendicant means. It means a beggar. That's what we are. We rely on people to give us donations in order to support our life. And we live a common life in imitation of the apostles, which goes out. So Benedictines stay in the monastery. We live in the monastery, as it were. We don't call it a monastery. We call it a priory. We live here. We live inside a life that looks something like the Benedictines. But it has some very important differences. One is that we go out. Another is that we study. Okay. We'll come back more to preaching in a minute. What about after the 13th century? You have, for example, the Carmelites. Their kind of most important period is a few centuries after the Dominicans were founded. So think of St. John of the Cross or St. Teresa of Avila. Here you have less emphasis on monastic practices. Certainly less Gregorian chant and beautiful liturgy. They really want to minimize that in order to have a strong interior psychological orientation to a prayer life. Contemplation becomes like this inner silent prayer, whereas for Dominicans it really was more meditating on the mysteries of God. And then you have after that the more apostolic or active orders. So the Jesuits are probably the most famous example, founded in the 16th century. With the Jesuits, you have no more monastic life at all. They do not have a chapel like we have. They do not sing the Psalms together in common. St. Ignatius said he did not want the Jesuits to come together to sing the Psalms. You have a much diminished common life with the Jesuits. Why? Or what do you have? You have a priestly life. You have the spiritual exercises, so very strong elements of a kind of psychologically attuned prayer, which is supposed to sort of forge the Jesuit in these very profound spiritual experiences so that he can then go out into the world and be totally immersed in his apostolate without a community that he's constantly coming back to and living as a part of. So that's actually quite a different way of thinking about religious life. And then many other religious institutes that are founded after the Jesuits often resemble the Jesuits in many ways. So that's a kind of landscape of the religious, different forms of religious life. So what's typical about Dominican preaching or a Dominican life? Okay, here, at the risk of putting you to sleep, I want to hand out, can you hand these around? This is an excerpt of a text. We're not going to look at the whole thing. From the great medieval Dominican St. Thomas Aquinas, after whom, you know, we named the Thomistic Institute. And, you know, if you come to study with the Dominicans, if you become a Dominican, you're going to become a friend of Thomas Aquinas. He's a major figure for us. And he actually asks that. Now, some things you need to know about Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas was from a very wealthy noble family in Italy in the 13th century. He was born in 1224. And his parents sent him at a very young age, probably something like 6 years old. Now, this was not that uncommon at the time. They sent him off effectively to boarding school. Where was he sent to boarding school? Does anybody happen to know? Monte Cassino. What is significant about Monte Cassino?
It's Benedict's monastery.
That is the monastery of St. Benedict. St. Thomas Aquinas was basically raised by Benedictines. He lived with them for most of his youth. And when he became a teenager, he was a very brilliant guy, obviously. So at 16, he'd lived with them for 10 years, basically, effectively, as a child monk. They weren't actually monks, but they lived in a kind of a boarding school, and they would have gone to the prayers with the monks, and I mean, so they're being formed by the monks. He knew the Benedictines extremely well. At age 16, he was sent to Naples in order to study at the university there. And while he was at university, he met the Dominicans, and he decided he didn't want to become a Benedictine, which was his parents' plan. Their plan was that he would, as the noble son of the aristocrat of the region, the family castle, you know, was not that far away, that he would become the abbot of Monte Cassino, of this Benedictine monastery. And St. Thomas refused that and instead joined this brand new, relatively unknown and shoddy, like disreputable religious order called the Dominicans, against the wishes of his family, who, when they found out that he had joined, do you know this story? They found out that he had joined, so he joined in Naples, and they said, okay, we're sending you to the novitiate. The novitiate's, I think it was going to be in Cologne, so he had to walk from Naples, Italy, to Cologne, Germany, with a few other young postulants, basically, and I think a couple Dominicans. They were on their way, and the family found out that he was doing this. Probably the letter that he'd written them or something got to them. They sent two of his older brothers, who intercepted them and kidnapped him, and took him back to the family castle and held him in the family castle incommunicado for a year to try and persuade him not to join the Dominicans. But he was so convinced that this was the right form of life that he refused all of their coercion. And finally they gave up and they let him leave. And then he did go up to Cologne and he did his novitiate and he became a Dominican. So St. Thomas Aquinas knew something about like the difference between religious orders and the significance of choosing one over the other. So this text is actually extremely personal for him. This comes from his great work, the Summa Theologiae. It's this great summary of theology, where he asks whether there are differences between the religious orders. Is one religious order better than another? And the traditional teaching, of course, was that contemplative forms of life are higher forms than active forms of life. Therefore, the contemplative orders are higher. That's the backdrop for what Aquinas is writing. And you'll see, does Aquinas agree with that way of saying it? And basically he says, yes, I agree, except the Dominicans, this new group, they do not fit into this model. And do you think that he thinks that they're the highest? Well, you know, I'll leave you in suspense. Let St. Thomas speak for himself. Okay, so he says the difference between one religious order and another depends chiefly on the end and then on the exercise. Like the end, what you're aiming at, the goal, and the exercise, what you're actually doing. Okay, so he says you differentiate the religious orders by what they're aiming at and what they're doing. So, this is the second paragraph. Hence, a religious order is preferable to another if it be directed to an end that is more excellent, either because it is a greater good or because it's directed to more goods. Okay, so now he asks about the active life. The works of the active life are twofold. One type of work proceeds from the fullness of contemplation, such as teaching and preaching. Parentheses, he's not saying this is what the Dominican order was founded to do. So he's talking about his own order there. He doesn't advertise that. And this work is more excellent than simple contemplation. That's what the Benedictines do. And look at his reason. It's in bold there. For even as it is better to enlighten than merely to shine, so it is better to give to others the fruits of one's contemplation than merely to contemplate. And I've given you the Latin there of Aquinas' original. Why? Because this then becomes the motto of the Dominican order, or one of the mottos. We have a few. One of them is Veritas. But another that you may have seen before is Contemplari et contemplata aliis tradere. Now, our translator here has given us that as to hand on, to give to others the fruits of one's contemplation. So it's to contemplate and to give to others the fruits of one's contemplation. But actually, if you look carefully at the Latin and you understand a little of the Latin, it's slightly different. The meaning is actually a little stronger than that. It's to contemplate. So the idea is Dominicans are contemplatives. They contemplate by their study, and then by their teaching and their preaching, they hand on to others, aliis tradere. Tradere is to hand on. So from it we get the word tradition, which is what you hand on something. And what do you hand on? Contemplata, what has been contemplated. The very contemplated thing. In other words, you don't just hand on fruits of contemplation, as the translator puts it. Actually, you hand on nothing less than God himself, who you contemplated. Now, this is a very profound truth. In the contemplative life, you gaze on God. And by gazing on him, you come to know him, and you come to love him more. You're drawn into his life. That is an amazing privilege. And that is the heart of what it means to be in the image of God. You begin to do what God does. He knows himself and he loves himself. As you contemplate God, you become like God. You are drawn into his life. It is the highest thing that the human being can be made for, with only one thing higher, that you would not only do it yourself, but you would hand on to others also this contemplation. And that's the point of the Dominican life. It's to be a contemplative that by teaching and preaching hands on the divine life which God wills to share with us. So that's why he says, this is the last line of the, just before it says reply to objection 3. The second to last paragraph, just before reply to objection 3, he says, accordingly, the highest place in religious orders is held by those which are directed to teaching and preaching, and then the second place to those that are purely contemplative, and the third to those occupied with external actions. Okay, well, that's, you might say, Aquinas is doing a little special pleading for himself there, because he's tooting his own horn, as it were, perhaps. But Aquinas is great wisdom. I'm persuaded, anyway. I don't know, maybe you are, maybe you're not. We'll find out if you apply to the order. Reply to objection 3. This is just a little side note that I threw in here. Aquinas has a lot of wisdom, and it's just kind of strewn about in the Summa when you read through it. The objection was about, isn't the best religious order the most strict one? Actually, this is what I was talking about at the beginning. Can't you just judge what is the best one by the most strict? And Aquinas actually says, no, you can't. Look at what he says. Strictness of observances, as the blessed Antony remarks. Who's that Antony? Antony of the desert. That's the father of monasticism. Strictness of observances, as the blessed Antony remarks, is not the chief object of praise in a religious order. You don't praise them because they're strict. And he quotes Isaiah, is this a fast that I have chosen for a man to afflict his soul for a day? It is necessary in religious life for taming the flesh. So strict observances are means. They're not the goal. They're how you get to the goal. And if they're done without discretion, Anthony writes, it's liable to make us fail altogether. There's a real wisdom here. If you try at the beginning of Lent to like have the most severe Lenten fast you've ever lived, and you're going to try and live it for 40 days, probably you'll make it for 3 or 4 days, and then you're going to break down and fail. That's the way to fail, is to do something like absurdly extreme. We're in this for the long haul. The point is to live this life until death. And so you want, yes, you need some strict observances, but you want them to be moderate so that you actually get to the goal, because they're not the point. So this is what Aquinas says. Wherefore, a religious order is not more excellent through having stricter observances, but because its observances are directed by a greater discretion to the end of religion, of the religious life. The question is, why are you doing the strict observances, and are they helping you as a means to get where you're supposed to go? So that's just for your own, you know, as you're discerning religious life, you might keep that in mind. Okay, so we've talked about this view of Dominican religious life. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about St. Dominic and the preaching, the grace of preaching. So St. Dominic, as you may know, if you read much about his life, there are some great stories about him. One story, which is depicted, if I'm not mistaken, in our chapel, in one of the panels opposite the stained glass windows. St. Dominic reputedly had a vision one night when he was in Rome. He was praying late at night in the Basilica of St. Peter's. Now, this was actually the old St. Peter's before the current church was built. This was the Constantinian Basilica. And he had a vision in the night of St. Peter and St. Paul coming to him, St. Peter carrying a staff, and St. Paul with a book. They give him these things, and they send him to preach. Now, this is a kind of icon for Dominican preaching. Why? St. Peter. Dominican preaching is tied to the teaching of the church. You could say it's doctrinal. That is, it's concerned with the integrity of the truth in its fullness, with its continuity going back to the age of the apostles, with the apostolic doctrine that is safeguarded by the keys of St. Peter. So Dominicans, from the very beginning, have been associated with the teaching of the church as the great defenders of the church's doctrine and the great expositors of it. And St. Dominic himself was entrusted with this task. And Dominicans after him have taken up that mantle. So the Dominican order really does see itself as having a Petrine dimension to its preaching, sent to preach by St. Peter, sent to preach the teaching of the church. But also St. Paul. Why St. Paul? St. Paul is the great apostle to the Gentiles. In other words, Dominican preaching is not just doctrinal, as if it were belonging in a theology library or something like that. It goes out. It goes out to the unconverted. It proclaims the gospel in a way that makes it attractive, that draws people to it, that gives people a burning in their heart to learn more about it. So preaching the faith to those who are very far off. So this is the trick. How to articulate the timeless truths of the faith, that Petrine dimension of Dominican preaching, in a way that's truly apostolic, the Pauline dimension, so that we really are disciples of these two great preachers from the Acts of the Apostles. So my experience actually in the Thomistic Institute is very much like this. We take the truth of the Catholic tradition out into the world where it is not known, and especially the teaching of Aquinas, who is probably, in my opinion anyway, perhaps the greatest expositor and teacher of the Church's apostolic faith, like giving you a kind of synthetic way of understanding the whole. And when you do that, you find all kinds of people come flocking to it. You don't even have to be that smart to do this. Why? Because in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. We're living in the land of the blind. So if you have something, you have a lot more than the people who have nothing. And I can tell you, you know, there's no reason for someone, even with a very modest academic or intellectual background, there's no reason for someone armed with the truth of the faith to be nervous about stepping onto an elite secular campus. Because you have something that they don't have, which is the truth. And the truth has a power that doesn't come from you. It doesn't depend on you. It comes from its own power. In fact, ultimately, it comes from God, from Christ. And if you receive the grace of preaching, you will have the grace to speak words endowed with the power of the Holy Spirit, and it will convert people. So you don't need to be a super highfalutin, academically credentialed person. You just need to be committed to preaching the truth and taking it to the world. And God will make it fruitful. And that is precisely what St. Dominic called the grace of preaching. So he did not hesitate to send men out to preach, even though they didn't have all the credentials yet. Now, okay, does that mean you don't need credentials? No. Does it mean that you don't need an education? No, far from it. We take that very seriously. That's why we have this whole school here. That's why St. Thomas wrote his Summa. Okay, it does matter that you form your mind. It's very important. You won't be as good a preacher if you don't use all of the gifts that God has given you. But God can work through whatever you've got to offer him, and he will use whatever you've got to offer him. So offer it to him, and you will be amazed at what he brings out of you. You actually have, you can bench press a lot more than you realize, in other words. And God's going to help you do it. So you just have to let him begin the work, and you will find out that actually he's lifting the weight. Okay. Another image that I'd like to use here, and we're getting towards the end. Matthew 7:13-14. Jesus speaking to his disciples. This is another great image for the Dominican preacher, it seems to me. Jesus says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide, and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow, and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few." The narrow gate has two gateposts. One is truth, the other is love. Enter by the narrow gate, the gate of truth and love. You enter the narrow gate by preaching the truth, which we believe really does set people free. But of course, it's easy to turn the preaching of the truth into something that you use to batter other people with, without love. Preaching the truth to show that I'm smarter, or I'm superior, or I'm going to dominate you or control you. That's, of course, the wrong way to preach the truth. And that is not a Dominican way. Even though we believe in truth and we want to be faithful to it, to preach the truth without love is not to be preaching the gospel, or at least not preaching it the way that Christ calls us to. And hence the second gatepost, love. You must love the people you preach to. You have to pray for them. You have to pray before you preach to them. I've been praying for you already today. Maybe you're saying, "Father, you should have prayed harder because you're not doing a very good job." You have to seek to do everything you can to give them the truth in a way that they can receive it and begin to act on it. So that requires a real kind of spiritual sensitivity. You need to know the truth. You need to not be wavering in your proclamation of it, but you also need to have a kind of sensitivity to how to present it in a way that can be received. Now, what did Jesus say? "If you enter by the wide gate, you will find the way is easy." You can become a priest or a preacher who gives good news that people want to hear. Worldly good news. You tell people only the happy side of the message. Perhaps you really do believe in the challenging aspects of the gospel, but you don't talk about it very much, and you minimize its importance when you do mention it. Love one another, be kind and generous, but you never get to the hard truths that people might actually really need to hear for the sake of their salvation. Now, people will love you for this. You'll be hugged like you're a fuzzy teddy bear. But this is taking the broad and easy way. This is not entering by the narrow gate. It's a way without the fullness of the truth. If you enter the narrow gate, you may find that the way is hard. It's much harder and more challenging to do, for example, what the missionaries of charity do, Mother Teresa's sisters. They live an extremely austere life in the service of the poor. There are other male religious orders who do similar things. Often they serve the poor in absolutely heroic ways, ways that I would find personally very difficult and challenging. But even here, the corporal works of mercy, like feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, caring for the sick and the dying, these things even the secular world regards as praiseworthy. And so you will find in that a certain love of the world. But try preaching the difficult truths to the world. The world will hate you for it. Jesus himself predicted that. Father, I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. And for their sake, I consecrate myself, that they also may be consecrated in truth. To be a Dominican means to be consecrated in the truth. It means to love our neighbors and their salvation, even if that means that we will not be loved back. It means to believe that the truth of Christ is a saving message, good news, the path towards freedom and happiness. But it will place you on the way of the cross. And that can sometimes be a lonely way, because the world may actually want to kill you, just like they wanted to kill Jesus. He foretold that that would happen to his disciples. So, if you don't want to preach the truth with love and to risk actually finding the way to be a little hard, then you might look for a different outfit. But let me give you the secret. The secret is, the way is only hard in a certain sense, because the Dominican life is the source of tremendous spiritual joy. Tremendous. I can tell you that since entering the order, I have discovered more profound friendships than I have ever imagined in my life. And certainly more spiritual consolations from helping other people. Being a priest and being a Dominican is a deeply, deeply satisfying life. It's filled with joy. There may be hardships, but in the end, the things that you have to give up are worth nothing compared to what you receive. The way may at times seem a little hard, but in fact, the destination is wonderful. And once you pass through that narrow gate and you begin to taste the delights of life with God, you will not regret it. If God is calling you to this life, you're going to love it. And he's going to give you the graces that you need to live it. And you may not be able to envision how that's all going to work out right now, but he makes a promise. You have not chosen me. I have chosen you. And I have sent you to go and bear fruit, that your fruit may abide. That is, in my experience, the life of the Dominican preacher. It's a life born of grace. It's a life of tremendous happiness. And it does a great deal of good for other people too. So I hope you'll join. Thank you. If there's time, we can have questions, or I don't know if you don't, if we need to move on.
There's 5 minutes, actually, before pizza comes, so, yeah. Any questions?
Yeah.
What's the greatest difficulty as a Dominican?
You know, when I was at a vocation weekend, I remember thinking, you know, I have a very heavy beard. Am I going to have to shave with, like, some cheap disposable razor for the rest of my life? That was actually a serious, like, question I was asking myself on the vocation weekend. It's not been a problem. That's not, materially speaking, you know, do you have every comfort? Not necessarily. But actually, you know, as you go on, I think you find those things are not the things that make you really happy. I mean, if you're entering religious life. So that's not a difficulty. You might say, well, chastity, you know, chastity seems like a very difficult thing. And of course, it can be difficult, especially at the beginning, depending on where you're coming from, you know. So if you've already acquired a habit of chastity, then you're going to find it much more serene, you know, going through the discernment process. And, you know, because unchastity is a major obstacle to grace working in your life. So getting that squared away is a kind of, that's necessary at the beginning. And so if you're not already, like, really making progress in that area, if that's still a serious issue for you, then that's the most important thing to work on. So getting that under control so that you're living chastity serenely. Why do I say that? Because if you're going to make vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, you do not want to, like, start living this life and still be, like, on the precipice of constantly falling with respect to chastity. What does that produce? That produces a guy who is externally living one way while internally, like, totally not living that way. And you don't want to get in the habit of having that kind of internal-external contradiction. Much better to get that squared away. But actually, what I would say is that's actually not that hard. I mean, it's hard at the beginning, perhaps, getting that virtue going. But with God's grace, you can do it. You can do it. It's possible. I've seen it happen. I've helped people through it. It happens. You know, it's like building muscle. You just need to do the training, and it's God's going to help you. He wants you to be chaste. He's going to help you. You'll get there. Trust him. Keep at it, and then it becomes much more serene. And then you're really able to. So what does chastity enable you to do? It enables you to give your heart to God, to be consecrated to God, to have chaste relationships with other people so you can really help them without turning it into a lustful selfishness. That's extremely important for the life, for example, of a priest. You have to be able to do that. So is that difficult? No, I've actually not found that to be difficult. Obedience is more difficult as you go on. And that's maybe natural because that's where you have to surrender your will. And, you know, it's not easy to do that. So I can just give you a very brief, story. When I was first ordained, I was sent to my first assignment, so as a young priest. And I was kind of doing my own thing because I had my idea of what my life should be like. And after a few months, my superior called me in, and he was like, Dominic, what in the hell do you think you're doing? Like, you're not doing this? You're not doing that? He really corrected me sharply. That was painful. It was like, it made me angry at first. It was like a little humiliating, you know, whatever. it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. I mean, looking back on it now, I am so profoundly grateful to my superior for having corrected me like that. I needed it. We all need that. I mean, we're deluding ourselves if we think that we can just, you know, figure out the path of our life and it's all going to work out because we can judge for ourselves. That's not true. Other people often have much greater insight into us and our defects than we do. And what I've discovered is that the Dominican life, as I've gone on, I didn't really appreciate this at the beginning. I was just reflecting on this the other day. You know, so I'm now in the order since, what, 2001, so coming up on 17 years. And I'm just now beginning to see the tremendous charity that the brothers have for each other, which means that even after you know, you like, you live with me, you know all my faults, you know I'm actually a loser, and you see the, me do again what drives you crazy, and yet you have mercy on me and you forgive me again. And that happens, I mean, I can tell you, that's the only way that a religious community functions, you know, continues to function, because the men love each other. They don't always like each other, you know, in the sense that, like, you might have somebody you don't really get along with, but, I mean, or irritates you, whatever, but, you know, okay, that's, they love each other, and they keep coming back and saying, I'm going to do it again. I've made a commitment to this way of life. I'm with these brothers for my life. Like, we're just going to back to work on it. It's like a marriage, you know, and that is real. So, I think that's the cue to end.
Great. Give him a blessing.
Sure. The Lord be with you. May the peace and blessing of Almighty God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit come down upon you and remain with you forever. Amen.
Okay. Thank you very much.